Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this, welcome to the Film Realist Podcast, the film and TV podcast from a complete nobody. That is hopefully for somebody. My name is Kyle Naranya, and welcome to episode 211. And on this week's episode, I'm going to be reviewing Moana, the live-action remake, but I am not alone. I am joined by Allison Hambrick, who was just on the Supergirl DC Studios review with me and Andy and all of our friends. Allison, welcome to the show.
Excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
I wish it was under better pretenses. I guess that's because this is a feature film review, we're going to have a brief non-spoiler discussion, and then we're going to get into this live action remake and all the things we're going to chat about. Time codes will be listed in the description. And then after that, we're going to react to a question of the week responses. You have been warned. I guess get your lace skirt and we're going to go to Matanui.
Correct.
Well, hello, tiny human. Not too sure why they thought I needed you. You could take back the little human. I'm going to eat whatever that is.
It's a chicken. His name is Hey Hey.
His name is Yum Yum when he goes in my tum tum.
We are in non-spoilers for Moana. It's the exact same as Moana 2016. Okay, thank you very much. We're going to go into spoilers.
That's not too different from what I would have to say from a non-spoiler perspective. You know the songs, you know the story, and unfortunately, you know most of the cast. So
I sincerely feel like there's not a ton to talk about. If you've not seen the cartoon, I don't know why you're going to this directly. So there is nothing really to talk about. Anything that would be different or any criticism based on the actual live action film is baked into knowing the animated film. So apologies if you wanted an extended non-spoiler discussion. It's impossible to have because this is a remake of a film that is only 10 years old. So we are going to go right into spoilers because it's going to be the most interesting part of the conversation. You have been warned.
What are you doing?
Escaping?
The hardest that way.
We'll never get it.
Okay, I'll do it.
Hey, what am I going to steer with? They're just going to kill you.
Allison, we chatted about what movies in July you were going to join the podcast for. And we landed on a 10-year-old animated films live-action remake that I don't really know why we have it. I mean, the behind the scenes of why this exists is not going to be interesting to the listener, but this is a very pivotal point for, I think, kind of where we are in this era of live-action remakes. So we can talk about that afterwards, but what did you think of this remake?
Well, before I get into my thoughts, I want to correct you on something. It's a 9-year-old remake. It doesn't turn 10 until November. They couldn't even get that right. It does not turn 10 until November. So it's only been 9 years.
You are correct. And I have a really funny story I want to tell you about the animated film. So it came out, as you've just said so perfectly, in November of 2016. For whatever reason, it wasn't something I saw in the... I think even the first month that it had come out, my sister had seen it, which was incredibly rare. Like, I have the film and TV podcast. Love you, Haley. Mm-hmm. Haley does not. So I hadn't seen the movie. And I don't know. I couldn't tell you why, because I had seen Tangled. I'd seen all the films in the CGI renaissance of the Disney films in this new era we were in. And I hadn't seen it. And I asked my sister, what'd you think? She goes, yeah, it was really interesting. And so there was this like green lady who was like created all the life, and then things like she gets like a rock taken out of her, and then she was this like mad lava lady, and they had to return the rock. But the way that to which Haley described it, it was very confusing, and I had no idea what she was talking about until I finally did see the film and realized, oh, she just gave away the entire major spoiler of the film.
That's what I was about to say. That was like the whole ending of the movie.
Which made me laugh because contextually, it's one of those things where, like, you know, you can share a meme and it's four pictures that if you have no context, you don't understand what the relation is to the thing you've seen and realize they could be intense spoilers. So the nearly 10-year-old film is here. I don't even know, where do you want to start? Because these conversations are getting harder and harder to have. And this is why I'm so glad I'm not just looking at myself talking about another live action remake. Allison, where do you want to go first?
So I do think it might be helpful for me to share, and I will be brief, a little bit of my opinion on Moana originally, because I think that informs my opinion going into this, because in a lot of ways, it's the same movie. I did not connect a lot with Moana the first time I saw it back in 2016. It was a movie that had to grow on me. Never because it was bad. I always knew it was a good, well-animated movie. I was a freshman in college when it came out, and it kind of had to grow on me. I was not in a space where I was watching a lot of Disney, and I was not as receptive to the message of the movie. Then, over time, this silly thing happened. I worked in a nursery where I was around kids, and we were watching the movie a lot, and the more I saw it, and it wasn't that it wore me down, it's just I got older and perhaps was opening up a little bit more. And I started resonating with it more, and then also rediscovering the part of myself that was receptive to things like a lot of the messages, knowing who you are, what you want, having lost yourself and regaining yourself. Those are themes that I probably could have related to when I first saw it, but I wasn't open to it. And so I ended up really loving Moana as time went on. Now, the original movie, as much as I'm going to praise it over what we're about to talk about, does have its own faults. For example, one of my hot takes about the movie is that I actually hate Hey Hey. And I'm sorry to rip that Band-Aid off right now. I think he is over-the-top comedic relief that wasn't actually needed, especially because Maui himself is, while he's a pivotal character, he's also kind of a comedic relief character. So, like, there was just a lot happening, and I found myself, like, I wish that effing chicken would die. Like, Maui can eat it. I worked at Disney World, and one of the dads that came through on my ride, Peter Pan, wore a shirt, and it was, like, Montanui fried chicken, and it had Hey Hey on it. And I was like, where did you buy that? I want it. So that's the level to which I did not like Hey Hey. So, that's a mild spoiler for my opinion on that later in the review for the live action version. But that being said, Moana is a very well-constructed movie, the original, with a great voice cast. The music is awesome. The only real complaint I have about the music in the original is that I didn't really vibe a lot with Tamatoa, but I like Jemaine Clement. Like, he did a good job. And I know that it was inspired by David Bowie, who I do love, but that song just didn't quite work for me. And perhaps it's because Moana lacks a traditional villain song, and that's the closest we have. And it's not on the level of, like, a Be Prepared. So maybe that's kind of, I'm holding it, yeah.
It's Shiny is a terrible song, and I hate having an opinion that even has the word terrible song written by Lin-Manuel Miranda. Like, I feel like those things shouldn't be allowed. Like, the universe should implode because I hold him in such high regard. And I obviously was not able to review Moana when it came out in 2016. Yes. I did review Moana 2. And so I definitely love the original once I eventually did see it. And going into this, it exists, and we talked about very briefly before we recorded about, like, going in and doing our best to not have any preconceived notions. But one of the major contributing factors to these movies existing, outside of, and I'm not blaming anyone who works on the films, but from a brand standpoint, creative laziness to just retread things that they know have worked. Being a millennial, growing up through the Disney Renaissance period, those were the real first ones where they did this too. And some of those worked, some of those didn't. And then getting some
of did it to some of the 50s ones.
Yes.
Cinderella got hit and then the 60s with Jungle Book.
Yeah, and then we went all the way back to the 30s, or no, early 40s.
We don't talk about that one. It was 1937, but we don't talk about it.
But they've done so many of these that we're now getting, as you movies that I was in my mid-20s for, which falls in that generational gap of, I have no idea who this is for, because if you're 10, you're still obsessed with the animated versions in a way. Like Lilo and Stitch, I understood to some degree, and there's some connection here, all of us, obviously, with Polynesia and whatnot. But let's get into it, because there are some things about this movie that really did work for me. Most of those reasons are because it's just the animated film.
Yeah.
And other things where I was surprised. And the place I want to start is with Moana herself, because Catherine, we talked about this before we started recording, pronunciation, Lagaaya. There's been different versions of how her name is pronounced. We're going to do our best, because Polynesian languages are not ones that we're baked into, but going to give everybody the respect they deserve with their names. Hello, Kyle Naranya. I would say in most of these live action remakes, they have really managed to capture, pun is actually intended for this, the magic of those characters. The difference here, and this is not a criticism of Catherine, the production behind this movie, and I said this in my trailer reactions, and it was incredibly frustrating, especially coming off of The Mandalorian. This is the volume part two in terms of, I don't know how much they actually went to real water. There's an incredible set design for the village, and the tangibility of this is something that is so inherently important in representing this community. And I love so much that it feels lived in and like real people are there, and the culture and the way that it's celebrated, and bringing that to the forefront in a live action film is incredibly important in representation of such a small percentage of the world getting another chance to be shown on the big screen. I love that stuff. And I think she is great when she has people to talk to. I was reminded of some early green screen work where people were not truly given an idea of what they're working with. And this was a struggle for adults. She is a nearly 20-year-old actor that has to react to a lot of nothing. And that is incredibly difficult. But the rapport she has with her family, specifically, of course, her grandma, because that is such a fundamentally important relationship. I love those scenes. Regardless of that, like, this is going to be something we are going to say a lot. You can clip it if you want. When they're doing just the best scenes from the movie, for the most part, they're the best scenes in this movie.
Yep.
Which is fine. I've been annoyed by the live action films not finding a new avenue to present the new story, which is just incredibly annoying, because we have the original animated films. And what I love so much about animation as an art form is you can push so many things, whether that be the camera direction, the use of color, music, whether it being diegetic or the opposite. Like, you can do so many things that live action films just don't have the capability of doing. And when you're having to rely so heavily on CGI to mirror the visual effects, or not the visual effects, the look of the animated film, half your movie winds up becoming CGI just because you're not going to put people in the circumstances like fighting Taka. They're not going to build a big lava monster. Maybe if they were making this in the 60s.
They may not even be able to.
No, exactly. Stop motion maybe would have been really cool. Yeah. But we don't live in that era anymore. So I thought she was really, really great. I was going to jump into Maui, but I want to hear what you have to say first on our titular character.
She actually is my biggest plus, because while I can't say she fully saved the movie for me, she put in a valiant effort, and I think she had a very hard act to follow, because Ali'i Krivalia was great as Moana in the first one, and she had a lot of difficult songs to sing. She had a difficult task of performing by herself in front of a green screen, like, or a blue screen, like you said, but she delivered on both of those fronts, and I do think she was very charismatic, and I think she carried a lot of the scenes, and I won't get too much into the negatives yet, but I will say she carried a lot of the scenes where she was next to a seemingly lethargic Dwayne Johnson, so.
Let's talk about Maui. I found myself baffled. I really did, because I am unapologetically a fan of the Fast and Furious franchise. The best one is obviously Fast Five. When Dwayne The Rock Johnson was introduced into those films, and they've gotten worse as he's been in them less. And obviously, rest in peace, Paul Walker, because that did affect the films in the real world as well as creatively. But after watching The Smashing Machine, which was his I can act movie, and I'm not saying that to be disrespectful of the film, it was really great to see Dwayne test himself creatively because he was a guy in a beige or gray shirt for like a decade. And I'm not never going to criticize anybody for putting money or for putting food on the table. However you want to do it in Hollywood, that's fine. Mm-hmm. They're not all those movies are for me, and that's okay. But the Maui character in the original film felt so reminiscent of the characters that I'm an old man in terms of looking at all of this stuff now. And I know that, and that's okay. But being filled with just love for the supporting characters, like thinking about Iago, the genie, Mushu, the list goes on with so many incredible supporting characters who kind of, to some degree, are more beloved than the titular heroes because they're allowed to be the funny ones.
Maybe not Iago.
I do love me some Gilbert Gottfried. But what's so frustrating is this isn't someone coming into a role they are unfamiliar with that they're having to be faithful to something else while also bringing their own spin, which Catherine had to do. You were Maui. You know what to is it be expected of Maui. I don't care that he's wearing a muscle suit. Whatever they want to do to make the movie work, you're going to make the movie work. But what's seemed to be a charisma-less performance, which is so odd from Dwayne.
There have
been films that have not worked, and it's been fairly public for the most part on why they didn't work overall. We were chatting about Black Adam earlier. And you are re-bringing to life, maybe, I would. It's easily in his top five beloved roles that he's brought to the silver screen. And I'm genuinely in shock. I don't know if this was feeling like, well, I've just got to do something that I think is going to be a win, or the direction of this, because I feel for Thomas Kail, because this movie was storyboarded and then made, and then you're given the job to your cinematographer and all the other people involved. Make it look like the thing. Like, there's very little room as a director to actually, and Thomas Kail has directed some incredible pieces of work. And to not like Maui in the movie is a true failure, because you've done this already.
I think this is a perfect example of a time in which maybe bringing back the original actor wasn't the right choice and they should have gone in a different direction. Dwayne Johnson is incredibly charismatic. In fact, I would say that that's part of what led him to being put in a lot of action movies where he played the same character every time, was because he's a suitable lead. He does that well. And as much as people want to hate on him for it, and those some of those movies were of varying quality, not all of them. I actually kind of like the Jumanji sequels. But that being said, a lot of it came down to his charisma. And I recognize, though, that he didn't want to be known for that anymore. So he moved into trying to do something more serious with Smashing Machine. And then it seems like the thought that this was a vanity project has occurred to me, in that he's a producer on it. He's reprising one of his most popular roles. It's coming after a couple of box office failures. However, I know that it wasn't necessarily filmed. I don't recall the filming dates. The Smashing Machine may not have been out yet at the time that this filmed. That being said, it really does read as there wasn't a lot of heart coming from him in this performance, which is baffling because he gave an amazing performance as Maui before, twice. And I didn't particularly like Moana 2, but he was good in it. Ali'i was good in it. Like, the cast did their thing. And also, the role was more or less written with him in mind to play Maui. So not only is it a role that he defined, but it was a role that was created for him. And so it's kind of disappointing to see it turn out this way, but it almost makes it seem like maybe this would have been a good time to give another actor of Polynesian descent a break.
Jason Momoa. He needs his
big break. That time, yes, of course, the unknown actor Jason Momoa. Although he may not have needed a muscle suit if they put him in this role. And The Rock has previously been as big, if not bigger, than Jason Momoa, but I also know he's, I think he's slimmed down a bit. And I think that had to do with the smashing machine, but I don't know for certain. But anyhow, we're not here to body shame. The muscle suit's fine. If that's what Disney felt he needed to be in for it, I don't think that it's fair to call him out for that.
I think it had to do with the tattoos. There's like the amount of application that would have been required, right? And you have it stenciled into something, you can just sort of, like, it is his superhero costume.
Yes.
For the
Her guy would have been in the chair as long as Rebecca Romijn. Like,
yeah,
that would have been miserable. So, I mean, I don't know that that's among the things that people have criticized him in this movie for. I think that's lesser among them. The wig, I actually think, can have more criticism just because I think they could have invested a little bit more in it.
It's terrible. It's really bad. I did find myself sort of trying to track the hairline of where they
that's
put
part
it
of the
them.
Problem. It's like they didn't, I don't know. I feel like they could have, and maybe they did spend a lot on the wig, but we've seen some good wigs in movies, even on actors that are bald. So like, I don't know. And then the other thing, and I hate to even say this part, but for me, especially with it having been a decade and, you know, Moana's still like 15, 16, it stood out to me a little bit to have Maui be played by an actor in his mid-50s, not in a creepy way, because that's not their dynamic. But in the original movie, I would say their dynamic is almost more like sibling, brother, sister kind of vibes, the way they play off of each other. And so having an older actor who is older than the actor playing her dad, because he's about 3 years older, playing that part does fundamentally throw off their dynamic. And I will say, I think it could have worked, but I probably would have rewritten it a little bit.
I was trying my best when leaving the film just to not be like, Dwayne, you're too old. And I couldn't contextualize to myself why I didn't think it works. And I think the fact that you brought up, it's much more of a sibling relationship when Moana at the time of filming would have been 18 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So that it does really hurt the dynamic. And another thing, and this is one of those inside baseball things, you've done set visits. I have not. My film school has been watching every made or bonus feature and listening to every commentary. You can tell when they are in scenes together and when they're not. Mm-hmm. And that is incredibly frustrating for a dynamic. And this only comes from the fact, and you can't have this conversation because this is a remake. These relationships are pre-established and you know what works about them. And not only do we have Moana 1, you've already brought it up. Great point. Moana 2's biggest crime is it was a TV show that they crunched down into a series. Yeah. But that Moana and Maui, that actual story and where it takes those characters, I sincerely love that story. Mm-hmm. There's chunks missing as because of the way that it was planned out.
Yes.
The way in which the dynamic in this film is presented, it doesn't have that warmth and that back and forth that is supposed to be the backbone of what makes the movie work. The emotional core is Moana's relationship with her family. And as you've already described so eloquently, the self-realization, whether who you've been in the past, who you are now, and how those things are affecting your current choices in the present. The other part of that is the Moana's relationship with Maui. And it just doesn't work. By the time he leaves in this version, my main thought was, I'm surprised you didn't leave already. Like, when were you enjoying this relationship?
Yeah, and he seemed like he didn't want to be here. And maybe The Rock didn't want to be here, and that's why. And that's a hot take. But maybe he didn't want to be here and it came through in his performance. But the other thing is, if you're going to fundamentally change the dynamic of the characters, this is a remake. It's okay to write them a little differently. So if you're going to have mid-50s Maui with teenage Moana, it's okay to write them like that's the dynamic. And, you know, one of the key conflicts going into this is that she's having disagreements with her dad. So if we're going to have older Maui, maybe have him be a surrogate father figure who helps her realize things that are wrong in her relationship with her dad. And some of it's him, some of it's her, and ways to meet in the middle. Like, there's more to be mined there if they go in that direction. But they were, it reminds me of the 2019 Lion King, where it's like they were so afraid, other than putting a Beyonce song over one scene, of deviating from a moment of the original, that I actually think it hurt the movie. And then the few places they chose to deviate were not the right ones. And so, I don't know, here it seems like maybe they should have at least tried taking a risk. And I support trying those things, because they don't always pan out. A lot of my complaints about the Disney live action movies are where they've made changes that didn't work. Like, my hot take that our friend Andy will hate to hear me say is that I do not like the 2017 Beauty and the Beast. I don't think it's very good. Part of the reason is the casting for the leads. I don't particularly enjoy Emma Watson or Dan Stevens in their roles. But also part of it's the way that they rewrote the movie. They made some changes to how LeFou and Gaston treat Maurice, and they cut out the asylum bit, and then they added that book where they can, like, leave the castle through it. And I feel like none of those changes really served the story in any major way. I think the animated animated movie, having them bond through reading itself was enough without having to add this being a magical book where they can go look at Belle's childhood home.
And that her mom died of syphilis.
Yeah. I thought it was the plague, but the timeline would probably say syphilis. But all of that is to say, they did at least take some big swings. Sometimes they're going to work, sometimes they don't. And we'll get into the live action movies I like later. But, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. One change I did like was in Aladdin, when they said, instead of going through the convoluted, the Sultan says you can marry who you want. It's like, hey, Jasmine, why don't you inherit being the Sultan instead? And that kind of solves the problem in a different way. That was a plot beat that made sense to change. There are other problems with that movie, but that particular choice was a good one. And I think with Moana, they had room to make some good and different choices, and they didn't. Or even some bad and different choices, and they didn't.
Well, and the one space that it does feel padded, and in a way, not in a way that I would say is a criticism, we spend more time with her parents. At least yes. It feels that way. And in one of the sort of, it's a classic element of storytelling, is you have a disagreement between two characters, and then you have mm-hmm. them go on a journey. And then that character winds up essentially venting to the new character because they see similarities with somebody that in their real life. Like, I am, as I'm saying that, thinking about something that came up in Shrinking in the most recent season, which is mm-hmm. a great scene between Harrison Ford and Jason Segel. And I think you're right. It's so frustrating, because when you are doing these, I understand the hesitancy to want to change it at all and feel beholden to something, mm-hmm. but not understanding how these version or factors in the separate parts of this art form change. Animated mm-hmm. films, for the most part, have to be more elevated and more exaggerated because of typically mm-hmm. the audiences that they're mostly targeted at. And with a live action film, when you're bothering to do this in this version, you actually do need to lean more into the characters' relationships and their drama. Mm-hmm. And I am frustrated that you've suggested what could have been, because I think that is a complete lack of awareness in the way they're presenting the story this time. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want anyone listening to this, if you watch this, and I've had a lot of conversations in my real life about the live action How to Train Your Dragon, which is just the cartoon with some minor changes here and there. I did a review on it. Everyone can go listen to that. The one thing they added was the foresight to talk about the mom, because they knew what had happened to the mom because they made two other movies. I actually was kind of hoping, because we have already had Moana 2 by the time this came out, maybe you could have worked in her sibling dynamic. Something that, because the biggest frustration I had, and I wouldn't say I get bored, because I love Moana. I sincerely do. I was a little annoyed, side tangent, because I've listened to the soundtrack quite a bit. I do know all the words to You're Welcome. Not hearing Lin be a part of This Is the Way.
We know the way.
Yes, sorry, We Know the Way. It's a different Star Wars brand. It was, since it did sincerely shock me. I was sitting, I knew what was going to happen. I'm like, oh, we're going to hear Lin. Where's Lin?
So I have a funny story about that. The first time I saw that movie, it actually, because Hamilton was so popular at the time that the movie came out, it actually fully pulled me out of the experience the second it switched to English and Lin started singing. And it's not that he's bad, and I do not think there was anything wrong with him singing that. Although I will say it was kind of a relief to not be pulled out of this experience by a Hamilton jump scare. So, I like that they let him be on the soundtrack, so don't misunderstand me there. It was just kind of funny because, and keep in mind, I was a freshman in college, so like, wasn't always the most kind about stuff like that. I was like, oh my god, it's just Lin-Manuel Miranda, and he inserted himself in his own soundtrack. Which, to be fair, it's a great song. He does great in it, and whomever, I apologize, I don't know the singer's name, whoever sings it in this one also did a very good job. So, like, the music was good here. I will say that, as far as remakes go, I do think the original You're Welcome was better than this one, and I don't particularly care about the additional run, but...
That is the best example, and you brought up Beauty and the Beast. You have such iconic, colorful, fundamentally like personality forming sequences. The Disney Renaissance, there's a reason it's called that, everybody. Do yourself a favor, because it is what Disney's animated films have been, animated Broadway musicals that won all the awards for a lot of the time for song. And what you get when you're making an animated film, as I've said this already, is you get to make it as colorful and as crazy and wacky, and characters are doing incredibly wild things. When you just take a person standing and stuff's going around them, it doesn't have the same impact.
Yeah,
I think it was a mistake to use any of the You're Welcome footage in the marketing. The Rock punching the rocks that formed him. I don't know if this is true, or if they did do this. One of my favorite elements of the original Moana is the animator responsible for Moana's tattoos was the animator who handled the genie in Aladdin.
Oh, now that would make sense, though.
Yeah. So I'd be very curious, because it's very much like You Ain't Never Had a Friend Like Me, You're Welcome.
Yeah.
That I'd be curious, because I would say the best element outside of what Moana brought, or Catherine brought to Moana, was the tattoo felt very much like the same character. And I will give them credit. I liked how they integrated the tattoo into visuals beyond just being on Maui. That part I liked. But part of the problem with this version of it is the Rock is asleep through this version of the song. And it's just, that's the energy. We've already talked about it, but it's very much the annoying, because two movies of a character that I really, really like, and just not the case. Honestly, I was really hoping they were going to cut Shiny. I don't like that song.
I'm glad you feel the same way, because that seems to be a hot take. I've heard a lot of people do like it.
But... I prefer, so I didn't love Moana 2, but Get Lost, it's presented very antagonistically of Moana, right? Because we don't really know what that character's allegiance is going to be. But I really like that song because of the purpose it serves in the story.
I think you can count that, despite the narrative in some cases going against that. I think you can count that as a traditional villain song because I think it was written with that sensibility.
Yeah, it's
and so
it's,
that makes a difference.
Yeah. I think it's the best song on Moana 2. But yes. Shiny and the Crab, another element that I think you get away with when it's animated. Mm-hmm. I am not Polynesian. I don't pretend to know anything inherently about Polynesian history. Where I would have appreciated some sort of expansion is like, how do the Kakamori exist? Like, yeah. I understand the mythics of gods. I'd say we're more predisposed to like Greek and Roman gods because of the way that they sort of impacted Western. Obviously, they came from Europe. Obviously, that goes without saying. But then like in how they were so important in their influence into modern, not I shouldn't say modern, but even the creation of most popular fictitious characters now, Superman and all those characters are baked into those myths that Taka and Tafiti are, they look incredible. I will give the movie credit for that. I thought the visualizations of those characters were really great. I'm still confused with the Kakamori because they just show up and they seem to be even smaller. And that sequence, I think, is shorter than it is in the cartoon.
I want to say you're right. I do think part of that comes down to the restrictions of like having an actual human actor interacting with them. Like, I think that's also why we see a lot less of Pua, I would say, in this movie. But yeah, with the Kakamora, I don't know. I actually wasn't huge on that segment in the original, but I didn't hate it. Love the little Baymax Easter egg with the one that has his face on it.
Oh, I totally missed that. That's awesome.
That's in the original. That's not in this one.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Well, it might be in this one, but I know it in the original. One of them, their little, it has like a painted Baymax face on it. And I love Big Hero 6, but that's off topic. But I agree with you that I question the logistics of them. Although I think we're kind of just supposed to accept that they're some little weird fantasy pirate creatures and just take it at face value, which, as you pointed out, is something that's a little easier to do in an animated movie than in a live action one. So maybe they could have thought through some different obstacles for Moana to face if they were going to make some changes. So, okay, we cut Shiny. What else can we do? Okay, maybe the Kakamora aren't going to come across as well in live action. What can we do instead? That kind of stuff. And maybe it's best they didn't do that.
I don't know. I feel like I've said everything. I don't want people to feel like dunking on this because it's easy. I like Moana. This is Moana. But the conversations about these movies shouldn't just be, they did the thing that worked already. And when you don't do that as successfully, you're going to wind up with a film that's like, I don't think you can skewer this and say, oh, it's absolutely terrible. There's a lot of incredible work. Shout out to Molly Freeman, who talks about the craftsmanship behind a lot of what goes into this. And that stuff can't go undiscussed. And I do really appreciate, and I mentioned it, the tangibility of some of this. But I am also reminded of this movie cost in 2026 dollars. It's alleged, because they're never going to confirm these things, $250 million.
I had to brace myself because I hadn't actually looked this up yet. I'm not surprised.
But other Disney films that have also taken place on the ocean, here's an example of one critically maybe received more mixed. Pirates of the Caribbean cost $225 million back in 2006, which still to this day is regarded as having some of the greatest visual effects ever put to film.
Were you talking about At World's End?
No, I was specifically talking about Dead Man's Chest. I mean, At World's End is even more expensive. Yes, that's 300. But the 20 years just kind of rolled off the tongue, almost to the date we're recording today. But that cost $225 million. I liked it because it was less, and it created Davy Jones.
Amazing villain, amazing portrayal, and the CGI was so well done, and it holds up to this day. Like, I think a lot of the work done on Pirates of the Caribbean looks better than modern work, and I'm not just talking about Moana when I say that, but the CGI was just so convincing.
Well, and one of the reasons I brought up that franchise in particular, because there are other expensive movies, The Electric State, but those films spent a significant portion on the water.
Yes.
And what I did not enjoy was any time specifically, you can see this in the trailers. If you want examples, everyone is always backlit because apparently the sun is pivoting around whoever needs to be talking. It'd be like me turning off my lights when you're talking and then turning them on when it's my turn. Be very odd. That prevents the immersion of the adventure when it feels stale, like the volume or an actual location. But I, this is Moana. I don't know. I feel like I have run out of things to say. Do you have any other final thoughts on Moana 2026?
You know what? I can do a lightning round. Number one, I don't understand why they straightened the actress's hair when her natural hair that we've seen in like press and so on is actually more similar to the character. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is bringing up the lighting. I actually thought there were some moments where it was incredibly obvious that they were in front of a green screen. And it was weird because there were scenes that felt overexposed to me while also at the same time being very obvious that they weren't outside. So it's like, why is this overexposed when you have no natural sunlight? So stuff like that does kind of stick out to me. And I'm somebody that can be a little bit forgiving of some wonky CGI here and there. But that kind of stuff, like especially if it just reaches the point of looking so artificial, can take me out of it. And I say that as somebody who's a fan of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. But I think part of the problem that Moana faces that those movies don't is that Moana, while it's fantasy Earth, is still on Earth. And the ocean and sunrises, and we see those things. So it's so when they look uncanny, we are going to notice that they look uncanny. Whereas if you're out in space, that's not something most people will see in their lifetime, at least in person. So you're going to be a little bit more forgiving of some of those more outlandish settings. And actually, that's kind of the end of my lightning round. Actually, wait. Famatoa, one thing I noticed in the original movie, he had the same pupil dilation problem that David Bowie had, where David Bowie had gotten in a fight, so one of his pupils was more dilated than the other. In the remake, for whatever reason, they gave him heterochromia instead. I don't hate that decision. It's just kind of a bummer because it took out like the little David Bowie tribute. And that could
well, he's
just
a mutant
because...
now. So now Charles Xavier can go up to him in a bar and tell him he's got a sexy mutation.
Yes. That's a couple I don't want to think about, actually. Thank you. Famatoa x Charles Xavier.
That will do it for our spoiler thoughts on Moana live action remake. And there have been a fair number of this. I don't remember when exactly I did this, but I made a tier list. But we're not going to do that because that will take a very significant portion of time. So what I asked Allison a little bit of her homework was to, I believe you actually, you went above and beyond. I'll give you a virtual gold star. So do you want to start with your least favorite live action remakes or do you want to start with your favorite live action remakes?
You know what? Let's start with least because then we can do sequels to live action remakes.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I will put Mufasa on that list only because I do... Least.
Sure.
And I do think it was a well-made movie. I think in a lot of ways the cast delivered. The plot didn't fully make sense. I don't understand why they hated each other so much by the end. It was all about a girl, and it was a girl that was never interested in Taka anyway. So
men
like,
are stupid.
I mean, yes, but like, I don't know. They were also children for a lot of it. And then my other big thing that makes me, and this is the vaguely irrational one, that makes me dislike Mufasa, is that Bye Bye song.
This is...
You're gonna defend the Bye Bye song.
No, I'm not. That is, so very, I mean, I talked about this Moana 2. I was sincerely bummed Lin didn't come back for Moana 2. Mm-hmm. I am truly bewildered. I've probably said that too many times on this episode, but it is the best way to encapsulate my feelings. Mufasa's soundtrack is bad. Yeah. Brother is not a good song. I don't care what TikTok tried to make me think it was a good song. It's not. Most of Mufasa the Lion King is not a good soundtrack. It's I said this when I reviewed it. I understand. And I would have done the exact same thing. They're like, Barry, come in. What do you want to make? Godfather Part 2, Lion King. And they go, approved. I understood it. I would have done the exact same thing. And yeah, it's just, it's bad. It's bad. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And what were the other two?
I hesitate to say this because I had a nice time the one time I watched it and never thought about it again. I'm actually going to put the 2019 Lion King up there as well.
Okay.
And the biggest reason, again, the characters can't emote as well with this technology. And Jon Favreau didn't really try to do anything different. And I understand that he had his limits with what he could do differently. And this could apply with Moana as well. We don't know if there were any studio mandates here and if he was told, change it as little as possible. That is also a possibility. But a lot of what did work in the original was lost, and even discounting the animation. Like, for example, I like Chiwetel Ejiofor. I think I'm saying that correctly. Very, very much. I don't know that he was given the best work with a scar, because turning his song into a dramatic monologue just doesn't work, especially when that's what people wanted. It's almost like cut the scene if you're not going to have him sing it. And like, I almost feel bad saying that, because it's, you know, we see sometimes a lot of examples of actors being set up to fail. And I think that was one of them. Like, what was he supposed to do if they weren't going to have him sing it? And I don't know if he can sing or not. I will say that. Then they really shouldn't have done the scene that way, and they shouldn't have had him use the same dialogue and that sort of stuff. And then my weird complaint about this, and this is so hyper specific, partially because I like The Lion King 2 and some of the sequels, I'm really annoyed that they put that Beyonce song over him running through the savannah instead of during the Rafiki scene putting back in "He Lives in You." Like, I feel like if that's the kind of stuff that remakes are for, put mm-hmm. in scrap material that didn't make it into the original and in or tweak pendy. It or yes. Well, Yupendi's different because that is the love song for Kiara and Kovu. Get it right. Uh-huh. But "He Lives in You" was written for The Lion King and cut. So
mm-hmm. This another tangent. I love that you brought that up. My sister, she's being mentioned in this episode. She's not even going to hear this. Ailey, if you're hearing this, text me that day when you're hearing this and just tell me the time code because I'll look it up. She adored Lion King 2. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, like the first one, but loved Lion King 2. And her brain during portions of Mufasa the Lion King, because she didn't watch Kion. She's seen the movies and that's it. And her brain.
Okay, so no Lion Guard.
No Lion Guard, no. But trying to understand like what they had done to the established Lion King continuity. Like, this is not comic books that have been running for 60 plus years, but it was incredibly funny just to see.
Well, there are actually like three or four different origin stories for Scar and Mufasa across Lion King media between yep. Mufasa, the Lion Guard, as we mentioned, and then I know that there's a book version, and then I'm not sure how much they talk about it in the original movies, because I know they don't in the first one at all. It's been a minute since I've talked about two, and then they don't talk about it at all in Lion King 1.5, which regrettably I've watched most recently out of all of the Lion King movies. And I only say regrettably because this is public, otherwise not regrettably at all. I wanted to laugh.
Dig a tunnel. Dig a tunnel. What was that?
That's going to be my head forever now. Thank you.
Well, quick before the hyenas come.
Okay, but that song is a bop. Not necessarily good, but it's a bop. Yeah. But yeah, so I think unfortunately those two do kind of take the cake. And part of why is because up until that point, I think the Lion King franchise had been really strong. In that even its direct-to-video sequels, which are some of the most panned part of, they're not even the Disney canon, but of the Disney canon, even the Lion King's direct-to-video sequels were good. Mm-hmm. And then Timon and Pumbaa was considered pretty good by way of the animated series that they used to do on Disney Channel based on their movies. And admittedly, I am a little old to have ever watched The Lion Guard, but I know a little bit about it. And even then, I know a lot of people really liked that. So it's almost more egregious that in trying not to rock the boat in their Lion King remake, they kind of tarnished a lot of what was special with what they'd done before. And mm-hmm. maybe that's an unpopular opinion. I know that movie's not the most well-received, but it's also not the most hated. Some of the others that are more hated maybe don't deserve it. I'm looking at The Little Mermaid, which is not on my list of least favorites. It's also not a favorite, I'll admit. But one more least favorite that I already alluded to is Beauty and the Beast. It's largely story reasons, largely Emma Watson's casting, because frankly, she was cast because she was Hermione and it's a similar archetype of character. She couldn't really sing, and even the acting parts that she did weren't amazing. Kevin Kline was okay as Maurice, a little bit of a different take on the character, but he was fine. And then the castle servant.
So for me, the biggest crime of that movie is that I thought Sacha Baron Cohen should have been Lumiere.
I agree.
Because that
I understand why they put Ewan McGregor. I get why he was cast, and a lot of that star power and the fact that he's just extremely well liked. And if you've seen Moulin Rouge, he does have a history in musicals. That being said, I don't think he was campy enough to be Lumiere.
Nope.
And to be fair, I don't know that I would have expected Jerry Orbach to be. Had I been told that, like, thinking about him in like Law and Order versus Beauty and the Beast, I probably wouldn't. Granted, I saw Beauty and the Beast before I saw him in Law and Order due to my age. But had that happened in reverse, I probably would have been very thrown off by he's in this musical, what? But then he was awesome and he was extremely campy and he fully leaned into the accent and was wonderful. And I think Lumiere is a character that you kind of need an actor willing to do that. And while Ewan McGregor, I wouldn't say he detracted, but he didn't add. And that's kind of the problem with a character like Lumiere, who's supposed to be like the biggest presence there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And some of the casting was fine. Like Emma Thompson was fine as Mrs. Potts. Angela Lansbury is better, but she didn't detract. Like, she was fine. And then they added a bunch of extra servants without giving them a whole lot to do. Like, we have Stanley Tucci and Audra McDonald in there, both great actors who I generally enjoy seeing. But their characters, despite we're told they're married and that the dog, the Ottoman dog, is theirs, and that's all we get from them. And it's like, why are we adding extra characters if they're not going to contribute to the story beyond just being extra people on screen? And so that was another thing that movie, it was bloated while also not being that long. And the original was so tight and so well made.
It's perfect.
That it's like, yes, exactly. Like, if there's a perfect movie, Beauty and the Beast could be in contention for that, the original.
Well, there's a reason it was the first animated film to be nominated for Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that doesn't happen by accident.
Yes. And then the one other thing I will say is I don't like the new song that they added for the Beast, and I would much rather, I'm sorry, part of it's that I don't know that Dan Stevens is that great of a singer. They also put a voice modulator on him, which really hinders the song. But I actually think his solo song in the Broadway musical is better. And in this case, it might have just made more sense to look at the Broadway musical and pull in those songs. And if we want to flesh it out, okay. What worked for the stage version? Not all of it did. Some of it did. There's an extra song for Gaston in there that's more of a comedic relief thing if they wanted to put that in. Luke Evans probably would have been game. Actually, he's my one plus I can say for that movie. His singing voice was very different from Richard White, and that took me out because he's not... Richard White had a very, very deep voice, and Luke Evans doesn't. But he did win me over the course of the movie with his performance, and I think it's almost a shame that he was in as bad of a movie as he was, because he was great as Gaston. Like, in a better remake.
I feel my least favorites, I'm just going to run them off. Like, it's kind of just a four-pack. The two Alice in Wonderlands, no.
Fair.
Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. Which is one of those weird.
I didn't even watch that one. It's so the only one I haven't.
And then Mulan. And the reason for Mulan is the exact reasoning on when these truly fail. And I hated that I felt this way because I was so excited. Haley, it's her favorite Disney film. She had sleep dresses. She had the clicky. I can't even remember what it was called, but where you had the, you look through in the pictures.
It's a viewfinder.
Viewfinder.
I have
one
of those too. Yeah.
Yeah. That if you take a movie and you went, okay, we're going to take Mulan, but we're going to make it Crouching Tiger, Hidden Mulan, or make it a war epic. And you do all, you try to please everyone and you wind up doing nothing. The fact that Yao, Chen Po, and Ping, they're
you might
there.
Have just reminded me that that's actually my least favorite one, but I think it, I've just fundamentally blocked out the memory of that movie because Mulan's my favorite princess. So
it's
I think
so
it's just the level
bad.
Of dissonance I applied to the experience of watching that movie that like I can't even rank it because like my brain doesn't want to remember that it existed.
All right, and then I'm going to rattle off my top three because yes. I've talked about them before, so listeners will know. Ironically, it has an actor from your least favorite. I loved Christopher Robin. I love that film. I think it does exactly what I'm looking for, which is it's not really a remake, but it is and it isn't. On the flip side of that, The Jungle Book is one of my favorites because it fixes narratively the issue with the structure of the cartoon. And then Pete's Dragon literally just takes the dragon and does its own thing, and it's better for it. So that's my top three. What are yours, Allison?
Well, now I'm reconsidering because I was like, oh man, maybe Christopher Robin should have been up there. But actually, The Jungle Book was in mine, which is what made me sad about ranking The Lion King as low as I did. Because I know that making The Jungle Book was part of what led Jon Favreau to want to make The Lion King. That movie was awesome. Like you said, it fleshed out the narrative. The kid who played Mowgli was great. I liked a lot of the voice performances we got to, like
Christopher Walken as King Louie.
Yes, Christopher Walken. I was going to call him out. He was amazing, although he was kind of, he was pretty scary. And then I really thought their casting choices for Baloo and Bagheera were on point as well. Like having Bill Murray, who kind of be his lackadaisical self. And then, I mean, I'm always going to be pro Ben Kingsley showing up in things. Maybe not Iron Man 3, but they've redeemed that since then. They've redeemed it since then.
I'm glad you had good things.
Yes.
No. I was just glad you love. Clearly, you enjoyed Wonder Man because that was one of my major notes.
I love Ben Kingsley, and yes,
cheering when he recreated a Mandarin video. If that was not on my bingo card for 2026.
That was so wonderful, and I love the way that they lampooned some of what people didn't like in Iron Man 3. So then my next movie that I would like to bring up is specifically Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella, and it's one that gets forgotten. It was a little bit towards the beginning, I think, of when all the live-action remakes were coming out. And I know for some people, I have heard accusations of it being boring. I think if you find that movie boring, you probably found the original animated Cinderella boring. That's really all I have to say to that counterargument. And that's not me saying anybody is wrong for being bored. It's just different things appeal to different people. But what I liked about it was it had a very strong aesthetic. And the costume design was amazing. The way that the story was told was amazing with the Julie Andrews narration. The performances were good. We had good leads. Lily James was good. Kit Harington was good. And then the supporting characters were all amazing. Specifically, I have to single out Cate Blanchett was amazing as Lady Tremaine. She brought so much to that role, like to the extent to where she was borderline a different character, but in a good way. Mm-hmm. She was as evil, but you really understood. And so they gave her such a strong arc, and throughout they gave her these moments where you do sympathize with her, and it makes the ending a lot more powerful when Ella leaves, but then she turns around and says, I forgive you, as she's walking out. And I don't know, little changes like that really, it bolsters the movie. And part of that goes back to what we didn't like about Moana and not going deep enough into the character relationships. Kenneth Branagh and I apologize, I don't know who wrote the movie, if it was him or he, if it was him, he probably had a co-writer. But that is to say, like, they really fleshed it out. They really looked at what can we make better, what needs to be the same, and they kind of adhered to that. But then the last one is going to take us in a completely different direction, unless you had more to say about Cinderella. I'm actually going to go way back in time to what most people don't think about when it comes to
the first live action 101 Dalmatians.
Yes. And it's because of Glenn Close. I'll be honest with you. I know that there are other elements of the movie that don't work, but
Glenn Close.
And she gives such an amazing performance. It's like she walked off of the screen in the animated movie. And to be fair, there are moments where they do try to modernize the movie without ruining the story. Like, it's set in the 90s instead of when the original movie was set, which I appreciate. And she's good. The leads are fine. They're serviceable. And a lot of their stuff is spent on their love story. So, you know, it's cutesy. And then, of course, you have, I think it's House, like Dr. House, and then like Arthur Weasley as like the henchman. And they're fun, too. One of my favorite decisions they made actually was not having the dogs talk in the movie.
I was thinking that, wondering if you were going to bring it up. Yes, I agree.
I actually think that was a great decision. And it also kind of made the movie cuter, in my opinion. And that could be that I'm a dog person. So, like, it's going to be cuter to me to see real dogs. But I also think that's an example of knowing your limitations, because talking dogs on screen can be very hit or miss.
I have seen that, at just as you said with some of the other films. I've seen that one way more than I've seen the 1961 original.
Mm-hmm.
Way more. So that will do it for any discussion. Actually, I'm lying. That will do it for the discussion on what live action films they have made, but it's a perfect pivot point to this week's question of the week.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
There's something I really need to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
So last week's question of the week was, what live action film would you like to see get an animated remake? And Allison, I know you have some options, but before we get to yours, here's what some of the listeners had to say. Mao Mao said, I know the question was live action to animated, but I really, 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 really want to see Atlantis or Treasure Planet as live action. And Mao Mao, what you've identified here, I think, is the thesis statement of what we actually want is films that were never really given a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I wholeheartedly agree with you there. I love me some Treasure Planet. I still have somewhere more from McDonald's. I don't know where he is, but he's somewhere. And then we have Stealth Bear 6693. I think Hercules would work really well, but I'm kind of scared. I'm assuming both of these answers are based on animated to live action, which is fine. Hercules is one of those things. It's been adapted so many times. I actually think we're going to kind of forget, even if Disney does do it. Like, I love the 90s version, but it's not one of my favorite films in the Renaissance period. Here's a good one. Rax B-Shot says Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Now, I've been thinking about this a lot. Between that and Mary Poppins, do they lose some of their magic turning what is a hybrid film into purely animation? I don't know, because I think, I don't love Bedknobs, but Mary Poppins, I think, could work really well, but I'm not sure. What do you think, Allison?
I actually, when I was thinking through this question, Mary Poppins did immediately spring to mind. And my first thought was, that's not going to work, because the consensus is splitting between live action and animation. And that was a big part of what Walt specifically wanted to do with that movie. So, I mean, if they could come up with another innovation to make an animated Mary Poppins movie worth it, maybe we combine traditional animation and CG, or we combine stop motion into there. I think it could work, but I would really feel like, especially for the imagination-based sequences, they would need to have a reason for it to be animated. And again, different art styles could solve that problem, but I wouldn't necessarily want them to touch Mary Poppins, because it being both live action and animated is so interwoven into its DNA and why it exists.
And then we have Dylan Pollock writes in, live action Disney film I want to see animated feels, since your mind goes straight to animation to begin with, what about Inspector Gadget, which should have always been animated, as opposed to Matthew Broderick weak sauce attempt we got? And you're forgetting, Dylan, they made a sequel to that.
French Stewart.
You know what? Say what you will about the live action Inspector Gadget film, it created one of the best Happy Meal campaigns of all time, which was, look this up on eBay, it was parts of Matthew Broderick So if you got them all, it built a like 2 foot tall Inspector Gadget. It's
build
awesome.
Your own Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, exactly. Who needs anything better? And then a beloved listener of the show, Allison, always writes in, his name is Scotty Cameron, with like a history lesson on something that I might not know about.
Okay.
So I'm excited for you to hear the first one. Scotty is an avid fan of very many things, and this connects to his thoughts on multiverse of color. That's a different thing. Masters of the Universe, although kind of the same, and Supergirl. So here we go. Scotty Cameron, I'm ready for this one. The funniest part about the comment about the extra layer of DC is it's because the 1980s Masters of the Universe comics were published by DC, and then later in the 2010s, DC would publish more Masters of the Universe comics again. Between the 1980s and 2010s, Marvel Comics through Star Comics were printing Masters of the Universe, and then Image Comics in the 90s and 2000s. Currently, Dark Horse publishes MOTU comics after DC's second tenure ended in 2020. On top of that, the original DC MOTU run from the 1980s started before the Filmation series. I didn't know that. Okay. And then the comics started in 1982 and the cartoon was shortly after in 1983. Now the mini comics that came after with the action figures were published in the 80s as well. DC's MOTU comics were the ones on comic book stands and spinners. The long-winded way of referencing Masters of the Universe and Supergirl together are a way of both mentioning DC's history. Now, that was because those are the two films that Scotty has seen this year, and he preferred Masters of the Universe, which is totally fine. There's no judgment on that, Scotty. I think we were all hoping that Supergirl would be unanimously the better film, but it is what it is. Now, Allison, you've had a lot of time to think about this. Realistically, it's like 6 hours, maybe. So what is your answer to this week's question of the week?
Am I allowed to walk you through my process? Because I thought about a couple before I got to one.
I love this. Let's hear the process.
Okay. So I already told you the Mary Poppins bit. And then another one that came to mind was Herbie. And that's because it's one that's not been able to be modern or well adapted in a modern context. And I say that like it wasn't 20 years ago, the last time they tried with Lindsay
Fully
Lohan.
Loaded.
Yes. But I think Herbie could translate well to animation. And I think that might be the way to circumvent some of the issues that the older movies have and that the Lindsay Lohan attempt had, especially because it is kind of an out of date thing where a lot of kids probably don't even know Herbie anymore. So taking that and doing an animated movie would work with that. Another one that came to mind was Race the Witch Mountain, which has already gotten a live action remake. But I think that's a story where they've kind of not done great either time. I think the original was probably better than the Rock's remake. Although he was fine in it and the kids were fine in it. But I think that's a story where it being animated might actually help with some of the action sequences that they've had issues with and that kind of stuff. But so that's one that comes to mind. And then another one I landed on as far as the classic era is The Absent-Minded Professor, which has also gotten a remake. You know the one, Flubber. I think about the Mambo scene probably more than I should. I have not watched it since I was a kid. I liked it back then, and I'm very aware of the fact I would probably not like it if I watched it now, which is probably why I'm never going to watch it again. And that's talking about Flubber. The Absent-Minded Professor I quite like. It's just a cheesy old Disney movie. You know what you're in for. It's almost like a Chitty Chitty Bang Bang type. Like, you know what you're in for. You're going to have a nice time. But I think The Absent-Minded Professor with modern sensibilities, as long as they don't go too Illumination with it, could be a lot of fun. And so that's another one I would throw out there as a remake. Although I think among those, Herbie might be best suited, especially because it's an iconic brand. So
those are, I love how deep cut those things are. And it's been so funny because obviously there's a conversation around Disney owning everything, but thinking about what IP they actually own that they're not doing stuff with. I mean, infamously, I hated the Artemis Fowl film because I loved that book series, maybe in 10 years.
It's we'll also get Kenneth Branagh.
Yep. Unfortunately. So those are great suggestions. As we are recording, Scotty decided to actually send in his answer. Scotty, you are quite, wow. All right. So his answer is interesting based on the whole conversation we've been having. I'm reading this live, Scotty. This is happening right now. Now, when I'm recording, not now when you hear it. That'd be weird. Scotty, are you listening right now? Send me a check mark right now. It might have to be Pirates of the Caribbean because that franchise has a lot of elements that lend itself to animation, particularly thinking about Davy Jones and the Flying Dutchman and know how their designs are primed for animation. Also, the Kraken would just have to be animated anyways, so maybe some sort of 3D, 2D hybrid. And then this is the best part. Scotty is a historian for the Film Realist podcast. No, you haven't asked this question before. Thank you, Scotty. Okay. 211 episodes in. I don't remember. So thank you to everybody who submitted their answers. Allison, I love the thought process behind how you came up with yours. And now for this week's question of the week, which is next week's review is going to be of The Odyssey. And that episode of the podcast can be 4.5 hours long. Just be excited, people. It may be a tenth of that. What was the first Christopher Nolan film you saw? Now, to answer the question of the week, you can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com. You can comment below on Spotify and YouTube, or you can at the Film Realist on any of the social medias. Just make sure to include the hashtag QOTW. And I get to read this to her face because this is our most recent review on Apple Podcasts. This comes from Allison, which writes, this made me so happy. And I asked Allison to send a star review as I would everybody who's been on the podcast or anybody who happens to be listening. But it's a segment, Allison. I'm so sorry. I mean, I'm not, but I'm going to read it anyway. It says, Kyle is a great host with a clear passion for movies. One of the aspects of his critiques is that make this show a good listen is that he seems to be rooting for movies to be good. A lot of critics go in ready to be negative, whereas Kyle seems to be finding something to enjoy in everything. And in those times he can't, his criticisms are based on the movie or show itself. A lot of modern media criticism has the pitfalls of bias, something Kyle largely avoids. If you want balanced in brackets and funny, I would say on occasion, reviewer, look no further. Allison, one of the jokes of this podcast and our mutual friend Andy always talks about a somebody and a nobody. And obviously I'm fully aware of the different phases that the Film Realist has been through. But anytime that I get the opportunity to talk to somebody that works in this field professionally, I'm not looking to do this. I mean, people would say, Kyle, you have a podcast. You're definitely a patent narcissist. And I'm not going to tell you what my therapist notes are. But regardless of that, sharing my passion for film and TV and getting to talk to amazing people about it. And your review went so far above and beyond what I was expecting that I just wanted to say thank you, because it means a lot that people who work in this professionally want to spend nearly 2 hours talking about a live action remake of a nearly 10-year-old movie. So thank you so much. Where can people find you?
So I write for Screen Rant. You can find me there. It won't quite be time for this, but come San Diego Comic-Con, I will also be doing coverage for Multiverse of Color. So keep an eye out for that. And then I'm also on Instagram @a_hamrick. I'm not hard to find.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I don't think this would have been nearly as interesting a review if it was just me talking about my issues with it by myself. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, if you are watching this on YouTube, make sure to like the video and subscribe. It helps the old algorithm beast that, you know, unfortunately, we have to abide by those things. And if you are listening on your favorite podcast platform, which happens to be Spotify or Apple Podcasts, you can do the same as Allison and leave a 5-star review. Helps the podcast get into those charts, heard by more people who might want to hear the ramblings of a random Canadian. That's me, not Allison. That will do it for this episode of the podcast. I will see you next week. Goodbye.